Assalamu alaikum, welcome to another Kalamcast episode. We've got a very interesting episode for today. Today we're joined with not just one, but two volunteer firemen. And with us is Brother Ahmed Jafar. He's originally from Dubai, not Emirati, he's Sri Lankan originally. He's 22 years old. He came to Melbourne a couple years ago and he's graduated from Monash University in commerce, and he works as an account manager, and he's been part of the CFA, which stands for Country Fire Authority, for over 2.5 years and has been a volunteer fireman for just over a year. And he's just very recently he's been elected to be the treasurer of his particular brigade, so congratulations for that, by the way.
Thank you.
And next we've also got Asim Siddiqui. He's an engineer by profession. He works in the telco industry. He grew up in Saudi Arabia, moved to Australia in the early 2000s for university purposes. He's been volunteering with the CFA for nearly 7 years, and he's been involved with the Muslim community in various capacities for over 10 years. So welcome to both of you.
JazakAllah khair for having us.
Thank you for having us, yeah. Let me ask, begin the most interesting question. Why did you decide to take the first step and get involved in firefighting, and why firefighting specifically than anything else?
So I'll let Brother Ahmed start and then...
Oh no, I was actually looking at you to go. So when I first moved to Australia about 4 years ago, I joined the Islamic Society and I made a lot of friends, you know, in the Islamic Society. But I didn't hang out with them outside university. So I was looking for friends to sort of spend time with outside university. So one day when I was cycling to Noble Park Masjid, there was just like a poster outside one of the shops that says recruiting for the fire brigade. So I went and I just messaged them on Facebook and told them that I was interested, not knowing what, you know, firefighting or anything was all about. I was 19 and I was just, you know, had that thing when, you know, when anyone's younger, they're like, I want to be a firefighter when I grow up. I want to be a policeman when I grow up. So I just wanted to see what it was about. So that was basically my initial step. And I went and I joined the Noble Park Fire Brigade. And I, you know, did the applications and yeah. So that was basically my first, why I wanted to join was just to make friends outside university.
Ooh, that's interesting. It seems like it was just something which happened in that particular moment. Or was it something that you'd been thinking about for a while? Something, somehow I want to contribute to the community in some way.
I wanted to, that's exactly right. I didn't, I was looking for something to do outside, say, outside university. And I wanted to volunteer somewhere. And this was the opportunity that just came at that moment, you know, to do something fun, to have like a lot of friends, and to say that, you know, I'm a firefighter. Not many people can say that, oh, you know, I volunteer as a firefighter. So when I went and joined the brigade, there were a few Muslims there already, and that would kind of drew me closer, and you know, from there it just took off. I was not a firefighter right away. There was like a lot of training and things like that involved, but I helped them out with the community fundraising and events. I went to the Victoria Police Ramadan dinner, met a lot of people there. Notably, one of their firefighters there was Sister Maha Shakur. If you know her, she's part of the Victoria Police. So yeah, she's very popular, and yeah.
So what about you, Brother Asim?
Yeah, so for myself, I think growing up, you know, I always wanted to help people out. And really, I think there's two events that led me to sort of join as a firefighter. The first was during the Black Saturday bushfires. You know, I woke up around that time frame. My car had been parked outside. And I was living in the northern suburbs, very close to sort of King Lake area. And I woke up one day and I saw that my car had actually been covered in ash from the, you know, all the fires that had been raging around nearby in the northern, the north of Melbourne. So that sort of incident really, you know, it pushed me to, you know, get involved and give back to the community. But it wasn't then that I had immediately joined. So I'd moved away from the area. Unfortunately, the area that I was living in wasn't particularly a CFA area. It was covered by the MFB, and MFB are largely a paid firefighting service, whereas CFA, they take volunteers as well. So it was only a few years later that I actually moved into a CFA area and eventually got involved with the CFA as a firefighter.
Okay. Those are both very interesting stories, I guess, and it shows that there is a type of motivation which comes between both. I think in your particular story was more about you could see the effects of something so large as, you know, the fires that were taking place.
Yep.
And I think a common theme in both of your shares is that you want to give back somehow to the community. Why is that there in the first place? Why do you think we need to give back to the community?
Well, look, as a Muslim community, first and foremost, you know, we're quite small in number compared to the rest of the population. But not just that, you know, there's also a lot of negativity associated with Islam and Muslims. And that was also actually one of the reasons why I wanted to join, because within the emergency services, you know, knowledge of Islam is basically based off of whatever people see, you know, on the likes of News Limited newspapers or on TV. And a lot of that can actually be quite negative. And with the CFA in particular, I think because a lot of the members are volunteers, they come from very diverse backgrounds. So their knowledge and understanding of Islam will vary significantly. And so a lot of people had a lot of misconceptions about Islam, even volunteer firefighters, actually non-Muslims, had a lot of misconceptions about Islam. So from my perspective, and I'm sure it'll be the same with Brother Ahmed, you know, it's to basically dispel a lot of that negativity towards Muslims. And personally, I can tell you that, you know, I've been out on the job a couple of times, and, you know, you see people look at you and, you know, see you as a Muslim, you know, Muslim firefighter, and it's bound to change people's perceptions, you know, so, even if at a macro level, but yeah, it will hopefully have some positive impact with regards to Islam.
So when you say that there are some misconceptions, what do you actually mean? Do you think it's a situation where people think that Muslims won't actually contribute in this way?
No, I think so. Just a couple of days ago, I joined Hampton Park Fire Brigade, and just a couple of days ago, one of the members in my brigade didn't know that Muslims do not drink alcohol, and I thought that if anyone would know anything about Muslims, you know, it's that they do not eat pork and they do not drink alcohol. You know, just adding to that as well, I was the first Muslim firefighter in Hampton Park Fire Brigade for over 75 years, and that area, that region in Hampton Park, there are quite a few Muslims, but none of them have, say, joined the fire brigade, and not many, and most members I've seen, most volunteer firefighters in the brigade, they do not know much about Muslims, much about Islam. It's only after I joined the brigade that they started asking questions. You know, when I said that I have to go pray or I'm fasting, it came as a complete shock to them when we were at a job once, and the job was extended. It was like a long job. And then they opened a ration pack and they started eating. And they asked me to eat. And I said, no, I'm fasting. I said, oh, what's that? I said, oh, I don't drink, you know, food and water. And they were completely shocked. And they were very sympathetic. But then I explained further, you know, what Islam teaches. And, you know, when they order food for the brigade, you know, I request for vegetarian and things like that, and I have special dietary requirements. They never had to face that in the 75 years. So alhamdulillah, I thought that this, you know, was like a perfect dawah opportunity for me. And also adding to what Brother Asim said, because in our gear, we have our names written on either our jacket or on our helmet. So my name, you know, Jafar, my second name. So I've just seen that naturally other Muslims just, you know, instead of coming to the person that, say, runs the job, they come up to me and they ask me, you know, if they're the ones affected in that, you know, like a house fire. They come and they see that they can communicate with me, say a brown person, and they just come directly to me and they ask me about the job. So I feel like, you know, inshallah, more Muslims should volunteer to give that opportunity for the public to come and, you know, ask us questions, because they're more comfortable like that.
So that raises an interesting question, and that is, how does firefighting affect your worship in terms of praying five times a day or fasting? You know, do you find that it's more difficult or easy? It's directed to both of you, not just one of you.
I think there are times when it is challenging, because so how volunteer firefighting works is that we just get a message, a page. Say we have a pager, or we have an app on our phone called BART, and we get notified of this.
What's it called?
BART, B-A-R-T.
Wow. Okay.
So we get notified of, say, an emergency, say, you know, X place in our community. So I volunteer for Hampton Park. So in Hampton Park, Lynbrook or Lyndhurst, that's where the brigade service is. So when I'm, say, fasting during Ramadan, I just see this emergency alert and I just go rush to the station.
Okay, so it's basically like a bat signal. Like,
yes. It's like,
you're a real-life superhero,
yeah.
Basically.
So we go to the station, we put on our gear, and then we say what we call is turn out in the fire truck to this emergency. So at that moment, we don't exactly know what we're going into. It might be, say, a false alarm, or it might be a job that might last 6 hours. So as fasting, you know, if you ask that example, is sometimes it can be a bit challenging. You know, we have heavy gear, we have heavy boots. Our helmet is also quite heavy, especially structural firefighting helmets. So it can be challenging, especially when we don't know what you're going into. But alhamdulillah, you know, there hasn't been any, because I've only been volunteering for a year now as an operational firefighter. So I've gone through one Ramadan. So alhamdulillah, it was all right. And praying as well. Sometimes when the job, you know, goes overboard, there are times when, you know, I can miss my prayer, but usually just go to the side and sort of, because I've spoken to the members in my fire brigade and they understand, so they know that when I tell them, oh, I'm just going to pray, they know, because I've already had that conversation before, and they're not like taking a surprise on the fire ground when that's the least that they should worry about, you know, when someone's house is alight.
Well, that must be very powerful in the sense that, you know, you're taking part in such an activity and at the same time you're showing your religiosity as a Muslim, basically, as the brother sort of alluded to.
Yeah, I remember this one job where I told my lieutenant that I had to go pray, and one of the members of the public overheard that and said, brother, you can come and pray in my house.
Oh,
and then he gave me a prayer mat and everything. So that was, and also he said, you know, you can use a toilet, you can
freshen
up.
Non-Muslim, obviously.
No, Muslim.
Okay.
He was Muslim. So he overheard that, and so it was shocking. I didn't expect that, and it's very, very nice to see. And that brother said, oh, you know, how can I join the fire brigade? You know, so alhamdulillah.
That's interesting. You mentioned something about the heaviness of the uniform that you actually wear, the protective uniform.
Yeah.
I imagine due to the nature of the work, you have to be relatively fit and healthy, right?
Yes.
Right. So what is the training like? Is it quite intense?
So for us, and I think, look, it really depends from brigade to brigade. So for us, for example, we had a 16-week training program. So, you know, basically twice a week you'd go in and... twice a week you'd go in and, you know, do your training for a couple of hours per day. Look, in terms of fitness, obviously it helps. So as a volunteer, I think the requirements are probably a bit less strict as opposed to, say, a paid firefighter. So, you know, we have people of all shapes and sizes in our brigade, you know, from extra, extra large, or, you know, quadruple extra large to, you know, relatively slim. So I think the key thing is obviously being able to, you know, so we have the fire hoses, being able to sort of bowl the hoses and hold those when they're fully under pressure, and, you know, just generally being able to carry yourself around, you know, when there's an incident on the fire ground. That's probably the key requirement there. So as long as you can manage that, I think, you know, you're able to sort of...
I think that's quite encouraging.
It's
very encouraging.
I don't think people should, like, say when, oh, being a firefighter, you should be fit. That shouldn't, like, put you off, because there's always different things you can do on the fire ground. So you don't have to be the person that, say, has a breathing apparatus on his back and walks into houses that are fully alight. You don't have to be that person who leads the job. You know, you can be a driver, and a driver is just driving and operating the pump, you know, behind a fire truck.
Right.
So you don't necessarily have to be super fit for those sort of roles. But as you said, you know, the basic, maybe the minimum is to basically carry yourself, you know. And even being a firefighter, when I was in Noble Park, I was a non-operational member. So you can still be part of the fire brigade and give back in, you know, supporting their community events or going around and teaching kids about fire safety or going to schools and, say, just maintaining their fire extinguishers. So all this money and this awareness and all just goes back to the brigade, you know, where they can use that money for equipment and, you know, just to service their trucks and things like that. So, you know, definitely, you know, you should all, I think, encourage everyone to come and, you know, join the fire brigade, because you don't have to be the fittest person out there. There's always something for someone to do.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. Everyone can contribute in some form or capacity.
I was going to say, one other advantage is, you know, that it'll help you get fit if you haven't been fit, because, you know, particularly when you're out there fighting fires, you know, holding hoses and having to move them around, it requires a lot of effort and you'll expend a lot of energy. So, you know, definitely that'll burn a lot of fat. And particularly when you're fasting and doing all that, you'll expend a lot more energy and your fat reserves as well. So
That's interesting to know. I understand the training goes on for 6 months. Why is it so extensive? Like, what do you do in this amount of time?
So look, again, every sort of brigade is different in terms of their training. So for us, the 16 weeks would be 4 months roughly. And so you start off, you know, with theory and a lot of theory content, you know, just making sure that people become aware of, you know, how fires start and, you know, the fire triangle, for example, is one thing. And just various concepts around fire. And then you obviously have the physical side of it as well. Again, you know, as I talked about earlier, bowling hoses, you know, holding the fire hose, actually, you know, using water and all that sort of stuff, and you know, actually playing with fire as well to some extent. So there's a lot of training involved around that, and that's just the basic. So there's a couple of different levels you can be. So the initial bit that you start off with is like a wildfire firefighter, which is the initial bit of training that CFA does.
Minimum skills.
The minimum skills. So that's the initial bit. And then once you've actually become a firefighter with those minimum skills, then obviously there's additional training after that as well. And for example, in our brigade, we have weekly training sessions. So it's twice a week for us.
Okay.
One on a weeknight and one on a weekend.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, you've also mentioned about, you know, in your training, playing with fire. You use the words playing with fire. That's actually a type of thing that we say when someone is getting into something dangerous, right?
Yep.
So that's what you basically do in a way, in some capacity, as a volunteer firefighter. Now, it implies that there's a level of danger in that type of work.
100%.
Without
right.
doubt.
Yeah.
Have you faced any difficult
yeah.
or dangerous situations, I should say?
Yeah. So just adding on to what Brother Asim said, is that we train, you know, for so long is because of the level of danger there is, number one. And number two is this call that we get, like a fire call we get, can be any time during the day. It can be 2 a.m. So if we didn't have the training that we have or possess, you know, and we go for training every single week, when you just go to the station at 2 a.m. and you're like still waking up, if you don't have the training, you won't know where the things are in the locker. You won't know what to do.
Mm.
You know, that natural instinct won't kick in. But if you've been training,
muscle memory, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. So if you've been training regularly, you know what to do even in your, say, sleep, you know. So, you know, just adding on that, we have to train regularly. So the basic minimum skills is becoming a wildfire fighter. And with that, you can basically go and fight bushfires. We learn, you know, fire behavior and things like that.
Mm.
And then after that, you become a structural firefighter where you're allowed to go into houses and you can, you know, your gear is also different. And you can go, you know, put out a fire inside a house, but not necessarily be the first one to enter the house and, you know, perform search and rescue with the breathing apparatus and things like that.
So I was going to say, even within the structural firefighting, there's actually two levels. So there's the basic structure firefighter, and then the next level up, which allows you to use the breathing apparatus, which is when you actually go inside the homes.
For like search and rescue, and you're you have, this is when this house is fully alight, and you've put on your BA, you've got, you know, a hose, you've got a Halligan tool or like a ceiling hook. And you're entering the house, you're basically searching for anyone calling, asking them
have
to call out.
Have you been in those situations?
So I haven't, because I have the facial, you know, the beard. Right. So breathing apparatus is usually a no-no if you have facial hair. So in order to actually wear the breathing apparatus, you have to remove the beard.
Clean shaven.
It has to be completely
totally clean. Totally clean shaven.
Clean shaven.
Clean. Because what it requires is a seal around your face for, you know, that breathing apparatus to work properly. If there's no seal, then, you know, there's a
escaping.
Risk that air can escape, and also the foreign pollutants can come
enter.
In as well.
Look, there is some real danger here from what you've described. How do your families feel about this?
So I was going to say, though, look, there is danger, but within the CFA, we're taught, you know, obviously not to be heroes and things like what you see on TV, you know, it's a lot of it's dramatized. Yes, there is danger without doubt, but at the end of the day, everyone has to be safe. And, you know, the number one thing is for us to stay safe on the fire ground. And that's the number one priority of any firefighter.
It's us first, and then
safety first.
It's us, the firefighters, safety first. And then it's the public.
It's
right.
like
yeah.
on the airplane, you put
yeah.
the mask
yes.
for yourself before you put
That's
it
right.
to the
exactly.
passenger next to you.
Because if we're incapacitated, how can we help, you know, anyone else? And that's just one less person on the fire truck that will be able to help out. So, you know, just going with that safety first, even if we're in the vicinity of the smoke, we all wear P2 masks.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, not just people who wear breathing apparatus and enter the house, we wear P2 masks. As soon as, you know, someone might see that it's like structural integrity, the roof is about to collapse in a burning house, they ask all the people with BA to exit, you know, regardless of if, you know, what the situation might be, because it's always safety first for the firefighters. And, you know, the training, they reiterate that, and that's, you know, that's number one, the number one priority. They would not put you into a dangerous situation. Number one, if you do not want to go. And number two, if the incident controller, who has years of experience, does not think that it's fit for you to go there, even if you do want to go. So you can go.
Yeah.
How do your family feel about it?
Yeah, well, look, so when I joined...
I'm the interviewer.
No, I was just going to say before we get onto the family, look, in terms of dangerous experiences, you know, again, even though, you know, we are trying to sort of be, you know, safe at all times, there will be sort of close calls and near misses that, you know, you'll come across. But alhamdulillah, I think from my perspective, you know, it hasn't been that bad. Probably the most dangerous thing for me would be, you know, just being really close to a burning, we had a burning slasher. So literally our truck pulled up right next to it, and we had to put the fire out off the back of the truck. And, you know, that's probably the closest I've been to real danger. I mean, at all other times, sort of, yes, we're fighting fires, we're going through the fires, but, you know, again, because it's safety first, you know, we try and avoid those situations where we end up, you know, being entrapped by fire, or where we end up, you know, in a position where we could potentially be in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
Does firefighters only do fires? Don't they do car accidents, search and rescue?
So we do anything from house fires to car fires to factory fires, building fires, bush fires. We do car accidents, what they call them, like washaways, where there's like oil leaking, it might be hazardous for on the road. We see people trapped in cars, you know, we help the SES. If sometimes
what is the SES?
State Emergency Services.
Okay.
So they also do rescue. So we either assist, we're first on scene, or we help them. The SES,
Does your brigade have rescue?
We don't have rescue, but we have... so there are some brigades where they have rescue. So in Hampton Park, the closest rescue brigade is Dandenong. So Dandenong responds their rescue appliance, which has a lot more, say, rescue capabilities, that they have more jaws and... you know, different things that might be required in, say, a car accident where there's someone trapped in them. we respond to like hazardous scenes where there's, say, an ammonia leak or a gas leak. So we go and we go diffuse the situation. Anything I've missed?
No, look, for myself, my particular brigade, we are a rescue brigade. So a lot of what the brother said, we're actually the people responding rather than, you know, the likes of the SES. So, you know, in terms of car accidents, you know, if there's someone trapped, then, you know, we have to do an extraction. And, you know, you'll come across other sort of rescue type of scenarios, particularly...
High angle, low angle
type of rescues. Yeah. Cat stuck in tree, lady stuck in tree.
Someone stuck in the mountains, you know.
Someone in a gutter.
Get
trapped inside a gutter. Right. You have some ajib scenario sometimes.
Anything
as well.
Come up to mind?
Not suitable for the podcast.
Okay. Yeah.
We had...
ask you later.
I think yesterday in the morning, about 7 a.m., I responded to a rescue where there was a car accident at an intersection. And they had one person trapped in each vehicle. So it was quite a bad accident and very due to dangerous driving. We're not sure of the particulars and things like that. But that was where, you know, it went on for about 4 hours, where we had to, so someone was mechanically trapped with their legs. And the other one was trapped also due to dole, and they couldn't get on. They were severely injured. So they had to sort of lift the top of the car out and take the person from the back. So there's always sort of those situations where, you know, you come close and you see someone in difficulty, and you see that person's family also in difficulty, you know, looking at those situations. So you know, those are like hair-raising moments, and you know, you're there obviously to help, and you know, you're also there, you know, if anything goes wrong.
Right. It sounds like you've gotten through them though, even though they've been difficult.
I've been quite to quite a few. I've just been turning out for 1 year. But I've been to about 160 calls, and a few of them have been like motorbike accidents where the person did not make it. I've been to a car accident where the person did not make it, and this is like not, they haven't responded, they haven't gone to in the ambulance, they've sort of not made it on scene. So there's support there in the fire brigade, you know, for situations like this. But alhamdulillah, you know, I have a very supportive family, and you know, my wife, and I feel like she's probably the perfect person I can go and talk to about this, because that's what the brigade help, you know, they encourage speaking, but they said speak to, you know, your family first, because that's probably your first point, and then if that doesn't help, then you speak to, you know, say a helpline or support line, and it's completely anonymous. And
so have your parents ever tried to dissuade you out of this?
My mom, I think to some extent she does. But my wife, so when I actually joined, I was single at the time. So obviously, you know,
is there a correlation? Like if you become a volunteer firefighter, it sort of helps?
No, not really. From a family point of view, my mom probably was the most worried, and so she would try to dissuade me a bit here and there, particularly when I had a family afterwards. But my wife, you know, she's been pretty good with that. I think the biggest challenge is, again, giving that time to the fire brigade, and effectively you're taking that time away from your family. And that's often the biggest challenge, particularly when you have a young family, you know, to take that time away from your family and you know, give that to the brigade.
That's quite understandable. So I think the question that most of our listeners are probably thinking of at the moment is, have you been involved in the relief efforts for the recent bushfires?
So
what
look,
has that been like?
Keep in mind there's, you know, you're talking about pretty much fires going all the way from Queensland down to Victoria and, you know, even Tasmania and South Australia. So I think for a lot of us, particularly where we're an urban fire brigade, and same with Ahmed as well, you know, oftentimes we focus on our particular area and the surrounding suburbs, but we do, there are requests that come through to you know, get volunteers to assist with the fires, whether it's interstate or, you know, particularly within Victoria, you know, sort of those other regions. We have been, my particular brigade has been asked, and we've actually sent our, so we have a for our trucks, we have a tanker. And we have a pumper. So the tanker is usually what we use to fight fires off the back of the tanker itself, usually grass fires, whereas the pumper is used largely for urban firefighting to some extent. So our pumper is actually committed to the Gippsland fires, and we have had members rotating across over the past couple of weeks. Myself, I haven't gone personally due to work commitments, and I think that's again the biggest challenge is work and family commitments. Usually
we should stress that you're doing this as a volunteer.
Yes, that's right.
We don't get paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah, and sometimes we actually have to spend money out of our own pocket to buy equipment or
for ourselves, a torch and things like that.
Do you have to work in the same district as you live to be in your brigade?
Look, you don't have to work as such. Generally the requirement is to volunteer. So you have to be within a certain radius of the fire station to be able to respond. So within like a 4-minute radius.
At minimum
of the fire station. Anyone who's outside of that, look, they will be taken for consideration. But I guess, anyone who's within that 4-minute radius is usually preferred. In terms of work, we have people, who do actually work near the fire station as well, or, within a certain distance. And so that helps because, they, at times they're able to sort of leave work and come to assist. But again, it's not necessarily a requirement. And again, it depends from each brigade to brigade as well on what their particular requirements are. So some will have, a need for people during business hours. Some may have just a need, for people to be there 24/7, for example. So it really depends on that on that particular area's requirements.
I think you stress also, why we say 4 minutes is because if there's a going house fire or a car accident where someone's actually trapped, like a very hazardous situation, you want to be able to respond a truck, as in like a pumper, because we're an urban fire brigade. You want to respond a truck to that scene, as the quickest you possibly can. So if you have members that are, say, 15 minutes away, that small, say a kitchen fire can be a fully blown house fire and two house fires if you've, say, been on scene in, say, 15 minutes as opposed to five, if that makes sense. So that's why they want people that are close to the fire brigade. But say then again, not all fire brigades only have one truck. They have three or four, like the brother has, they have a rescue truck. So if you don't make the first truck, that means if you're not there in 4 minutes and you say live 8 minutes away, you're there in 8 minutes, you can maybe make the second truck because they don't only need say one truck to be on scene. There might be a request for additional, appliances to turn out to that accident or that house fire. So you don't, be put off if, you're not 4 minutes away. You should always ask because you never know what the requirements of the brigade are because there might be so many.
Do you work with other fire brigades? Like if you're short staffed, short on volunteers, short on trucks?
So normally what happens is, so there's a couple of things. One is when... you get a page to assist another brigade. So they might request, another truck, for example, another type of truck. So they say, okay, we need a pumper here specifically, or we need another tanker for, wildfire firefighting. You'll get paged to assist that brigade. Other times what'll happen is because another brigade is, for example, busy with, an incident somewhere else, you might be asked to step into their area and assist with their particular incident or, just in general to step up into their area altogether. The other thing as well is, leaving that aside, you also have what's called a strike team.
Sounds nice.
So basically when there's major fires, you usually have a number of trucks which are allocated to a particular strike team. And so when the call goes out to actually get support for, let's say 10 trucks, 20 trucks, usually it's the strike team that gets called. And so you then go out and assist with those fires as part of that strike team, which is, a large number of trucks going to assist.
But do you have to go to your station to gear up before going to any other station?
That's right.
You have to go to your station. So like adding on to what you said, the minimum requirement for, say, a job is a Code 1 job. That means like with goes lights and sirens, is minimum of two pumpers. So I know Brother Asim has he has staff and MFB and brigades around him. Like for me in Hampton Park, we have two staff stations around us. So if Hallam and Cranbourne, so if Hallam are going to a job, we support them. Or if we have a job in our district, they support us. So there's always two trucks going to a job because you don't know how severe it is. And there's always a call on the, as soon as you get on scene, if there's a requirement for more trucks, or say Hallam are committed at another job, and what he was talking about is that they might respond another truck from the neighboring suburb, if that makes sense. So also the reason why strike teams are established is because, say if there's a massive fire in Gippsland, they wouldn't want to call all trucks in Hampton Park, in the Hampton Park area to go respond to that, because that will deplete the resources in Hampton Park or in the neighboring suburbs. So what they do is they pre-plan and they say, if there's a massive bushfire, you're going to have one truck from Hampton Park, one truck from Narrewarren, one truck from Hallam, and you form a strike team to go respond to this. So there's still other trucks, in the area to respond. Like, for example, speaking on the Gippsland fires,
right.
So I went in a pumper strike team to Gippsland for 5 days to fight the bushfires there. This was over, I think, just after, on the 26th, and I was there till after, until the 1st of Jan. I came back on the 1st of Jan, so I was there for New Year's and things like that. So the reason we went in a pumper strike team, so just for the listeners and everything, I think you said it earlier, so we have tankers and a pumper. So the tankers go fight bushfires, and the pumper is used for urban firefighting, like house fires and things like that. So we went on a pumper strike team because in East Gippsland, there are a lot of towns called, say, Bruthen or Orbost or Malakuta that have houses. So when these fires are coming close to these houses, they request a pumper strike team to attend to try and save these houses or save the town. The tankers will go in the bush and fight these fires and prevent them from coming to the town. But a minute the fire hits the town, we have capabilities where we can, have a lot higher pressure of water and things like this to attack urban buildings and stuff to prevent the fires from coming
right.
and hitting these towns and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that is coming out is that there's a lot that we simply don't know about firefighting, and
yeah.
I would imagine there's plenty of misconceptions as well. What are those misconceptions that people generally have about this kind of work?
I think you mentioned one is you have to be, super fit, and that's probably those right up there. Number two is, I just had it in my head.
Obviously there's this misconception that firefighters are heroes, but at the end of the day, they're not heroes. It's just ordinary people.
You don't need to be humble, bro. It's okay.
No, but to be honest, it's also about intentions as well. Sometimes you will get people who don't have the right intentions. And sometimes you actually get pyromaniacs as well who join the fire brigade. It's really about weeding those people out. So just because someone's involved as a firefighter doesn't necessarily make them a hero. You just have to be aware that sometimes you can get, people who aren't quite right in the head as well, who joined, again,
for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. For the wrong reasons. And I think, you can call it like a hero complex because, some of them actually light fires to go and then put them
respond
out later on.
Respond and go
and
put them out.
Just show themselves as
heroes.
Quote, heroes.
Wow.
I never imagined
that would be an issue. That's interesting. I think on that topic of intentions, there has been some, relief efforts and so forth. Some of it has been on behalf of Muslim organizations. And it's interesting to see how Muslim organizations are getting involved, the way that they're getting involved. What would you have to say about that?
I think it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think, good on them. What I loved about, this whole this relief effort was that there was a group from, I think it was Muslim Aid, that was on the news and plastered everywhere. They were very proactive. They were proactive because they went and did it before other people went and did it. They were probably one of the first people there to help out. And, normally Muslims are, I feel like they're a bit slow and they're a bit reactive. They do it after, say, other people. But, mashallah, this time they were right in the fire front, and news medias and, articles and stuff, they picked up on that. and they became sort of the proactive measure, and that they became the reason why other people are doing it and other organizations are doing it, because they went and they cooked food for all the firefighters, for the towns and, you know, towns that were affected. And then, you know, they put their name out there, and mashallah, you know, their pictures are everywhere, even on Daily Mail, that normally doesn't have anything good to say about Muslims. And, you know, mashallah, it was so good to see. And people in my fire brigade asked about it, and it's like always a conversation to have. And
do you think Muslims should be publicizing these kinds of things that they're actually doing? Because I know that there's been some talk about it online and so forth.
So look, I think there's two things, right? One is that as a community, you know, we're unfortunately under a lot of negative light. So to some extent, it's good to, you know, show some positivity around Islam and Muslims. Obviously, there's the aspect where, you know, we shouldn't be showing off and things like that. But given the current circumstances, I think it's better off to actually show us and have that visibility, you know, to the wider Australian public, given the current situation we're in. So I think there's more benefit in showing than there is in not showing us out there.
So one of the things that you've sort of, I guess, demonstrated in that answer, the answer before that as well, is that there's a religious element involved for you, at least. You know, how strong is that that motivation? Was it one of the primary motivations for getting into this field in the first place?
So I think, look, there is definitely that aspect. Again, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things was for me to potentially show Muslims in a positive light and, you know, help dispel some of those misconceptions. Again, as I mentioned, you know, even within the emergency services, whether it's CFA, police, or ambulance, again, they're people just like you and me. And so they get their information of Islam and Muslims from what's out there in the media, and what they see is unfortunately a lot of negativity. So to see someone, a Muslim, you know, either a member of the public or even a member of the emergency services, to see a Muslim, particularly with a beard, for example, you know, to be visibly Muslim, I think that has an impact on people.
I think that's a great way to sort of summarize the entire session that we've had today. Now, just to sort of wrap up and conclude, in terms of the bushfires, you know, if there's someone who wants to do something, help out in some way, what would you suggest and recommend?
Yeah, don't be a hero and get a garden hose and try to put fires out yourself.
Call 000.
Call 000. But look, for the bushfires that are happening right now, and look, one thing I probably wanted to touch on is we're in January, early to mid-January. The peak season for Victoria in particular actually begins around the late January, February timeframe, and goes all the way up until late March and sometimes even early April.
That's peak.
That's peak, yeah. Mm. So we haven't even begun the peak. We're just, you know, we're just beginning to go into our peak season.
Oh, wow.
Whereas New South Wales, I think they've already hit the peak, and they usually trail down. You know, from a few months now.
Because I don't actually think that people realize how terrible things are, because you described it to me over the phone.
Yeah, it was very, very...
I told the brother, by the way, don't tell me anything, just save it for the podcast. So
I think especially when I went to East Gippsland, you know, we were driving and the air around us, so we went from blue in Hampton Park and we went to like grey, and then it went to red, like where the fire's getting close, and then it went to just black. Mm. And we're, say, midday. And, you know, that was quite scary. And then when we're going, and then we can see this massive plume, and as far as, you know, the eye can see, there's just smoke, and it's massive. And it's as far as, you know, your left and right. And you can start feeling the heat. This is probably 1-2 km away, but you can feel the heat, and you can feel it's coming. And then we're all just trying to get prepared and ready, when we were blowing out hoses, you know, to try and protect this town. You know, there were some towns that didn't make it, that the fire just overran them with. The fire jumped the highway, and, you know, the firefighters, they did all they could. You know, Malakuta, the fire, people were trapped there. So alhamdulillah, we were a bit lucky where the town, the wind changed, and then the fire went around the town. And then the firefighters, we did quite well in preventing the fire from coming towards the town. So that was
what did you witness in terms of?
So it was a Monday that was the total fire ban, where there was low humidity high winds and high temperature. There was a recipe for disaster. And so the next day is when we went into, you know, where this fire was, and when we witnessed what the fire had done. Just trees on either side, just ash on the ground, trees on either side. There were no leaves, dead animals. You know, when you went on Monday and I saw dead animal, I'm like, oh, you know, I feel so bad. But then on that Tuesday when I went, after the fire went through, it was just another sight. You know, just animals, you know, we just got sort of immune to it because we saw so many dead animals.
Like ash.
Ash, yeah. Ash, and also they were just sort of like solid. They looked a bit like solid, like they were in place.
Frozen.
Yeah, frozen. Yeah, that's a better word.
I've seen a few pictures. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of, what was the name of that city that was cooked by the volcano?
Pompeii.
And
houses that were destroyed, people sort of abandoning their house the last minute. Mm. So what we saw when we were waiting and we were seeing the fire on that Monday coming towards us, we just saw cars just rushing, you know, passing by. So, you know, when you ask, you know, what should people do, is probably the best advice is to listen to the authorities when they tell you that this fire is going to be bad, you have to evacuate. Because the worst, the thing we do not like is that when there's someone trapped, and this is one of the instances where someone was trapped in the house in, you know, middle of the bushfire, and now we have to try and go rescue this person. So this person obviously would have heard the authorities saying evacuate, but then they thought to stay and defend their house. But now then we put, you know, ourselves, you know, in that situation. And also, you know, the next day, there were people just coming and taking pictures of houses that were burnt and things like that. They were preventing us from doing our job in terms of putting out hot spots. You know, there were still smoking trees. There were trees that were falling because when this fire passed, there were a lot of, say, you call them killer trees, and they kept falling. Just yesterday, there was a firefighter from fire forest management that passed away. He was second firefighter in Victoria to pass away, and he passed away due to a falling tree.
Oh, wow.
So trees, believe it or not, are probably the most hazardous on that, you know, bushfire, because they just fall. The three firefighters in New South Wales that passed away all had, you know, a tree that was, one, two of them were avoiding a tree, and the other one had a tree fall in their truck.
And it's not just trees, like even fires can also burn underground, and they can stay underground for a significant period of time. So people assume that, you know, it's safe to be there.
Walk on your slippers.
But it's actually,
it's cooking underneath.
Yeah. It's cooking underneath, wow.
So we put foam and we have a high pressure hose, and we try and get the minute we touch water, it just, steam just blows up. So it's like, there are things that, you know, the public, general public do not know about, and that's why you might see fire trucks in an area for a prolonged period of time, you know, after the bushfires passed, and your question might be, why are they still there? So that's what they're doing. There's fire burning underneath, and they're trying to prevent it. And you never know when this fire is going to come out. It might come out, say 10 kilometers away, you know, and this just might come out, and there might be another bushfire.
Wow.
So half the job is actually fighting the fire. The other half is actually making sure it doesn't reignite. So it's called blacking out.
Blacking out.
Mm. Yeah.
So unfortunately, we're ending on a very hopeful and a very sort of somber note as well. I guess the hopeful thing that we can take out of it, this is that, you know, there are people such as yourselves who are committing their time and their efforts into helping people and doing something about the problems that exist in the world, such as this one. And as you've mentioned, there are ways that people can, you know, contribute, as you two are contributing as well, right? So just to conclude, I understand Brother Asim is also working on a documentary. Can you just, are you interested in giving a 1-minute plug on the documentary? Work in progress?
Yeah, look, just working on something that inshallah will be highlighting Muslims within the emergency services. So, you know, police, ambulance, fire, and there are a number of Muslims within the emergency services.
No worries. We look forward to watching it when it comes out, inshallah, and perhaps we'll have you on again, inshallah.
Inshallah.
So thank you for listening. This is another Kalamcast podcast episode, and Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.